Too Aware. We are dedicated to communicating information that inspires your positive growth and change. Are you interested in a peaceful planet? Are you interested in optimal health? Are you living with purpose? Are you enjoying your life? We realize each person can make a difference, and our mission is to empower your awareness. The choices that you make in every moment shape your life, and we encourage you to realize that you have your own answers and to always listen to your own truth. We invite you to stay aware. Good afternoon. Welcome to the Aware Show. Hi, this is Lisa Garr. It's just so great to be with you today, and thank you so much for joining me. I have a couple of announcements to make. First of all, I have a great new series that's running on the on Gaia Television, and it's called Lisa's Inspirations. And I've done this show for about 5 years, and you can check it out at the website, which is lisasinspirations.com. But I took the meaning of the word I am, which Dr. Wayne Dyer taught me a lot about the I Am discourses and St. Germain's I Am discourses, and how that phrase, I Am, takes what you are wanting to create and moves it forward in the world. And so I did a whole series, and I interviewed 13 different visionaries on their meaning of the I Am and how it applies to their world and their work. And it was just such a magnificent experience to really take this topic that basically took on a life of its own. This I Am took on a presence in these interviews. So go and check them out. It's called lisasinspirations.com. And Marianne Williamson's up there talking about it right now. And Barbara Marks Hubbard and Jean Houston, in honor of our Women's History Month, have got some really powerful women on there talking about what it means to bring their presence forward in the world. It's just absolutely beautiful. But it's, of course, a very, very broad topic, the I Am discourses. It's really, trust me, it's gonna be a wonderful experience watching it. You'll get the whole meaning. All right. Okay, so that's at lisasinspirations.com. So here is just a fascinating topic. We're talking today about how our mammalian behavior, that was from the thousands, hundreds of thousands of years ago, and that brain that we developed way back then, how that is still coming into play today. Now, I think almost every interview I do, somebody talks about the tiger. Somebody's talking about the tiger in every interview, and the fact that we have this brain that was derived from us, you know, this fight or flight, and the tiger's no longer chasing us, but it's now in a different form, this tiger. So I know you know what I'm talking about. So joining me is Loretta Bruning, and she has a great new book called Habits of a Happy Brain. And she also she created this wonderful institution called the Inner Mammal Institute. And that's such a fun website. If you go to the innermammalinstitute.com, you can see all these different articles that she's done and interviews that she's done about how we are basically still operating from our mammalian neurochemistry. But she breaks it down by the hormones in our brains that are actually ruling and controlling our life still. So welcome to the show, Loretta. Thanks so much for joining me.
Hi, thank you for having me.
I love your stuff. It's really fun.
Thanks.
A lot of great topics of other books, your neurochemical self, getting real with a 200 million year old brain. That's just fantastic. What is it?
That's the name of my blog on psychologytoday.com.
Oh, sorry, your blog. Thanks. So you really love bringing about this, how we're not just, you know, all of a sudden having these experiences based on our current relationships. This goes back 200 million years on our neurochemistry. Talk about the basis of your work with the inner mammalian brain.
Great. So there's two separate things when you say the behavior goes way back. The specific behaviors don't go way back because each brain wires itself from life experience. So we are not born hardwired at all, but it's the specific neurochemicals, dopamine, serotonin, oxytocin, and endorphin, that give you a good feeling when you do something that's good for your survival. And our whole operating system is geared toward, I want more of that good feeling, I want more of that good feeling. So anything that triggered it for you in your past, that builds the circuitry in your unique brain, and that's why you're always trying to get more of it in that particular way.
So the neurochemicals are 200 million years old, or they've at least been identified. Yet how we wire our brains is a daily process, and rewire it is a daily process, which is...
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's a little more complicated in terms of rewiring. This is what we aspire to, of course. But what makes it complicated is that our brains are designed to wire themselves in youth. And our neuroplasticity is very high then, so we build the superhighways of our brain when we're young. Later on, our ability to rewire them is rather limited, so we have to work very hard at it. And even as we're working hard at it, it feels wrong because those superhighways tell you, you know, using your tiger reference, your superhighways are telling you the tiger's over there, don't go there.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
it's hard to go against them.
Right. And so that's what we're kind of dealing with, the delicate balance here of, and this is what your work is about, is really to explain where the brain and how the brain developed and then takes us into how we use this in a modern day context. So let's talk about the basics here of our brain and how it was originally wired. Tell us a little bit about that inner mammalian brain.
So we're designed to have a good feeling when we do something that's good for our survival. And when you take a step towards something that meets your survival needs, your brain rewards you with a good feeling, and then you want to take another step. So this is what we're doing every minute of every day, but the way we define survival depends on the neural pathways we just happen to have built. So we're not born with a definition of survival, but anything that made you feel good in the past is what wired you. And my book goes into a lot of explanation about it's so easy to see how this is how, like, a baby monkey is born with no knowledge and learns to find food and learns to meet its survival needs.
How did you get interested in this topic in the first place?
Well, I was a college professor and a mom, and I also, of course, had my own neurochemical ups and downs, like everybody. And so I was reading all the time various self-help books, and I would always read these references to neurochemicals in animals, but just very small references, and no one had ever connected the dots. So that's what I was doing once I realized how central this was.
Connecting the dots to our original behavior. And this came basically out of a necessity for you to understand conflict. Conflict. It's been present in your life a lot, huh?
Yes. So I grew up in a world, maybe a number of people have, where I can just be very frank because I don't have any living relatives, hardly. Mm. So my mother screamed at me all the time. And so during the first 7 years of life is when your brain is most plastic, and I grew up being screamed at. Mm. And so I very much wanted to avoid conflict, to avoid, you know, a sudden Holocaust that couldn't have made sense to me at 7 years old. That's what my survival brain was looking at. And obviously, once I'm older, you can't just go through life blaming your past. You have to say, well, so what do I need now? How can I rewire myself to make it better? And one thing I surely did was I was never going to yell at my kids, and I was going to be very nice to my students. And I was shocked to learn that just being nice to people doesn't work either.
Mm.
So I had to keep learning.
Well, you really have learned the meaning of conflict and the importance of it and why it exists in our world and has always existed in our world, but from kind of a different perspective. What's the the reason for conflict?
Most people have observed on some level food fights among animals. And today's culture, we're supposed to think that animals are loving, and if they have a food fight, we sort of explain it away. But this is how the world worked. And if you watch nature videos, it's sad and shocking, but true. Like, animals, they stuff their cheeks with as much food as they could get and then run away to some private spot where they could swallow so they don't get into a conflict and lose the food. So just getting enough food to survive was really hard. And then if you did that, then you had to get mating opportunity. And there was a lot of conflict involved in that. So if you take an honest look at nature, it's not really what people want to think. And it may be shocking, but it really helps us understand why we built a brain that makes you feel good when you get like a one-up position. And everyone says, well, yes, but we don't want that. Well, yes, that's true. That's why we have to work so hard to control that impulse. And it's like, how can I be happy with a brain that's constantly trying to get one step ahead?
Yes, with a brain that is naturally predisposed to resolve conflict. So resolve is the key there. Most people want to take antidepressants to ignore or to ease the pain of the conflict. And I think that's, and you say this in a lot of your writing, is that it is 1 in 10 Americans over the age of 12 takes an antidepressant medication. So is it because we have not been taught to deal with conflict in a new way and to rewire the brain in a different way for conflict rather than wanting to ease the pain of it?
Yeah, I think that's a great summary. I would add one little thing that just makes it a little more optimistic.
Okay.
In my mother's world, for example, the conflict was there and people just went around miserable and they didn't have antidepressants. So I don't think it's that people were better at it in the past. It's that we've evolved higher expectations and it involves such a high level of skill to work them out.
Right. That we don't have so much access to until, you know, recently, and it's really wonderful with all the great information that's coming out about the brain. And I absolutely want to mention, I don't want to make anyone wrong for being on antidepressants. Everybody has their own individual reasons, and I get that. But this information is to provide even more on top of that. So let's talk about how the dance between dopamine, serotonin, oxytocin, and endorphins dance together, what the reason and need is for each one of them, and we'll continue to explore the brain. Okay? So let's talk about dopamine. You talked a little bit about it. Tells you what's good for you, right?
Yeah. Okay, and I just want to add, I don't critique meds, but it's interesting for people to know that they tend to work, if they work, they tend to work for a limited amount of time. So if you're using them, it's really important to know that that's your window of time that you can focus on rewiring yourself in the ways that we're going to talk about rather than expecting them to work forever.
Cool.
So dopamine. So dopamine is the feeling of excitement that you have when you expect to get a reward. So an example in the modern world would be like seeing the finish line in a marathon, or I've made a loaf of bread and I've spent hours and I smell it and I'm getting all excited. So in the state of nature, when you actually get that thing that meets your needs, then the excitement ends because the purpose of dopamine is just to get you to take the steps. Once you've actually gotten the food or the mating opportunity, then dopamine stops and then your brain's like, okay, I've met my need. Now what? Okay, what's my next most pressing need? And you got to step towards that need to get more dopamine. So the idea that you could just sit on the couch and, like, there's this idea that if you're a normal person, that it's just flowing all the time, it's not accurate understanding of the mammal brain.
So it doesn't seek out those finish line experiences? Or it does.
We have to seek it. Yes, we have to seek out those finish line experiences. And it doesn't mean you have to be a superstar. You know, I use the example, I cleaned out my sock drawer, and I felt so good. And it took 10 minutes, you know.
Organization can do that. Yes.
So you could always find something to take a step toward in the next few minutes. And what I tell people is always have a short-term goal, a medium-term goal, and a long-term goal, so you could always be taking steps toward meeting your needs. And when one avenue is blocked, you can just start stepping on another.
I've always said that the human brain is designed to achieve. And I haven't meant it in a way of one-upmanship. I've just meant it in a way of these small, simple little victories. It causes the brain to release dopamine. Interesting.
Exactly.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
All right, now endorphins. What turns those on?
Okay, endorphin is the one that was first discovered, so it was the one we heard the most about in the past in terms of runner's high. And the sad news is that runners don't get high every time they run. And if you wait for runner's high to exercise, you're going to stop exercising. So it's important to know that what turns it on in the state of nature is pain. So if you see a nature video where a poor zebra is having a lion with its teeth in their flesh ripping it open, but that zebra is still able to run and save its life, because when you're in pain, endorphin masks pain for about 20 minutes. And you can probably guess that endorphin is the body's natural morphine, which is the same as heroin, codeine, oxycodone. This is what evolved in nature to help animals escape with their life. But it's not meant to flow all the time. And in small ways, we could get a little bit, and my favorite is laughing and stretching. And like if I'm sitting at my desk too long and I get up and I start to move, I'm going to get a little endorphin as I sort of creak my system into motion. But if I ran 2 miles every day, I would need to run 2.5 miles to get like the kind of high that people expect. And when you constantly try to work your body into a high, you're going to injure yourself. So we're much better off accepting that it's only there for emergencies.
Great way of explaining it. Okay, terrific. All right, so now we're going to find out how all of these four work together. But what is the role of oxytocin in the body, in the brain?
Okay, oxytocin is some newer learning, but now already has a cult following. So many people have heard of it. Oxytocin, it's often called the cuddle chemical or the bonding hormone or the love hormone. So in the state of nature, it's more complicated, though, so it's important to understand that. And long story short, it causes herd behavior. So we mammals were born helpless and vulnerable, and reptiles can make thousands of babies, but mammals can't. So a mammal needs to attach to its offspring and protect every single one in order for its genes to survive. So what happens is when you're born with a big surge of oxytocin and every time you're touched or licked, depending on your species, then you get more of it. Or if someone picks bugs out of my fur, or if I pick bugs out of their fur, they get more of it. But that's, you know, we have the expression, you know, I'm grooming someone. And that's literally, we're sort of designed to groom and be groomed. And sometimes we get frustrated with, let's say, office politics. But that's part of it. So it's safety in numbers that allows mammals to survive. And every newborn baby mammal transfers its attachment from its mother to its group. Since you brought up tigers, tigers are the one exception. They are solitary. And so a mammal, when it's with its herd or troop or pack, it feels safe. But if I walk over to greener pasture to get better grass, then my oxytocin falls when I leave the group, and now I feel like I'm unsafe. And this is what mammals evolved as a survival mechanism, because I can't really know every minute where the tiger is. And if I wait until I do, then it's too late. So safety in numbers is the mechanism, and oxytocin makes it feel good.
That's so interesting. So I wonder if reptiles even produce oxytocin, or those animals that let go of their offspring. Maybe they don't have oxytocin. Do you know anything about that?
Well, yes, it's mind-blowing.
Really?
Guess what? Their sex act takes like a few seconds, and they have it during the sex act. And the reason is because, and this fits our stereotype of like calling someone a reptile. A reptile is solitary, doesn't trust another reptile. But when their oxytocin is flowing, and by the way, it's not called oxytocin. It's another compound that has, it's another hormone, but it just has like one atom different. And it's released so that the reptile is willing to tolerate the proximity of another reptile for that interaction. We get a lot of it from sex in some different ways. What I tell people is, so oxytocin is trust. If I trust you or you trust me, both of them. So sex can be a long-term trust or like a real lot of trust in a short moment and then it's over.
Wow. That's so fascinating. Right. So, you know, I know some humans like that, but they need more oxytocin. But I also know that it tends to be a female hormone. Does it exist in men as well?
Yes, absolutely. And a lot of research is going on about that in the context of men and parenting. But I prefer to focus on what males and females have in common because it's not just the spurts. But like, for example, if you're watching a football game in the company of people you trust, whether it's a company of like three people or 3,000 people, or let's say 3 million people worldwide are all watching this game with me, that's all giving me that feeling of safety in numbers that the mammal brain likes.
Interesting. And you could call a radio show oxytocin because it does the same exact thing. That's right. I'll rename the Aware Show oxytocin. Okay. So this a safety numbers protection chemical, neurochemical. What about serotonin now? This is a biggie.
Yeah. So serotonin is a biggie and it's complicated. In the 70s, 80s, and 90s, there was a bunch of research on the serotonin spurt that a monkey gets when it one-ups another monkey. Now, this one-upping behavior, it's really unpleasant for us to think about it today, but people who lived alongside animals have observed this, you know, for generations, for millennia, really. And animals who get the one-up position, it enhances their, what biologists call reproductive success. They made more copies of their genes. And the other amazing thing is that 90% of our serotonin is in our stomach. And in nature, eating and being in the one-up position go together because let's say there's a banana there. If you're bigger than me, I'm not going to reach for the banana because you'll bite me. And so serotonin is like, it's pride. It's the closest human equivalent to pride. It's like, that banana is mine. It's not aggression, but it's like, I can get that banana. I'm not worried about that at all. And it's at the same time preparing my stomach to digest the serotonin.
So why do antidepressants pool serotonin? It doesn't produce them, right? It doesn't produce it. It just pools it, right?
Yes, exactly. Well, the closest equivalent I could think of is when aspirin started being used, no one understood how it worked. People just knew it worked. So it was the same thing. Antidepressants were invented for another purpose. It was like a heart medicine, and then it was just discovered without understanding the mechanism. So very slowly, people are trying to understand what the mechanism is. But in that context, it's so socially unacceptable to acknowledge this one-uppy behavior in the mammal world that this whole component is getting left out, even though you can see that this is how the world works. And I'm totally not saying that you should go around and one-up people. It's the opposite. I'm saying that when you have a perfectly fine, comfortable life, you can make yourself nuts, frustrating over, you know, who got a better table and who got a better seat. And this is what our brain evolved to do, but we have to work very hard to restrain that and still be happy. So in a way, it's sort of like lying to yourself and keep reminding yourself, you know what, this table I'm seated at is just fine.
Oh, interesting. So that's a very primal experience of getting a better table. But a lot of luxury commercials and what do you call them, vacations and so forth, prey on that need, right?
Yes, yes. And you know what? We all have our own way of trying to deal with that need. And the bottom line is whatever habit you have for dealing with it, if you keep doing that habit over and over, you're going to get in trouble. So you mentioned some examples of some, you know, you see some new product that you have to have and then you feel one up. For someone else, it could be, I'm going to work hard and get a promotion, but then you work endlessly. For someone, it could be, you know, I can drink more beers than you. For some, it's like, I'm a better mother than you are. I can run more miles than you. Whatever it is, you're going to overdo it if you keep relying on the same thing. So it really helps to understand where this urge is coming from. And then what I say is give yourself a wide range of tools to feel good so you don't over-rely on any one of them.
Or time.
And of course, the thing is, the thing about having a cookie, like whenever you feel like you're in the one down position, you can have a cookie is another famous example.
Okay, that'd be a lot of cookies. But the that's why so many people buy purses or buy new shoes and want that vacation exclusivity, so forth, is all appealing to the release of the serotonin in the brain.
Yes, exactly.
Makes
and
sense.
The minute you get home from that vacation or buy that purse, you know, not the minute, maybe a half hour, you know, that you're going to start saying, oh, I'm not in the one-up position. I need another fix of that feeling.
That's
you're
why.
You need another purse.
Mm-hmm. And but that's why what the SSRIs do, the antidepressants, is that they take that serotonin and they inhibit it from dropping out of the brain, and it keeps it pooled. And that's why those are that makes people feel so much in the go-getter, happy type of personality. That's interesting, very interesting. This really breaks it down for us. Okay, let's go to the hormone of cortisol. Now, cortisol, basically, well, let me go back to dopamine, endorphins, and oxytocin, and serotonin. When those are all working together, that creates a happy, balanced brain, yes or no?
I wouldn't say that. This concept of balance is the model that the medical profession has been used because of the disease model of happiness and unhappiness. But the word balance implies that there's some exact right amount that you should have all the time, as if, you know, I got my blood analyzed and this was my cholesterol and this was my blood pressure. But that's not how they're designed to work. They're designed to spurt when you have a specific life circumstance where you're meeting that specific need and this rewards you for steps toward that need.
So if, for example, you haven't spent time with your children, does that desire come out of a need for oxytocin to because the oxytocin is too low in the brain and wants to be create a balance in the brain, but it takes its turns, right? It's never all of those chemicals at once. It's taking turns of those spiking and then dipping and spiking and dipping, right? Is that right?
Exactly, exactly. Oh. And that's why we have these endless frustrating trade-offs. Like, if I want to spend more time with my kids, then I have to spend less time pursuing whatever that other goal was. And so we're always making those trade-offs. And if people are like, yeah, but why can't I have everything at all at once, you know, it's not really designed to work that way.
Well, here's the greatest, I love this line that you say in your work. And by the way, my guest is Laura Bruning, and her book is called Habits of a Happy Brain. And we're talking about retraining your brain to boost these different chemicals, neurochemicals that we're talking about. So here's a great line. Tough choices are the task your brain is meant for. That is great. That is such a great sentence. Tough choices are the task your brain is meant for. We try to shy away from those, or we labor over these choices. So can we talk about how the brain is hardwired and what it does when it gets into that tough choice position and why we can't make decisions?
Okay. I by the way, I don't say hardwired, but maybe you're thinking the pathways that we've built in our early years. So here's the fascinating thing. The operating system that controls your neurochemicals is inherited from earlier mammals. So anything a monkey can do, when I'm doing something a monkey could do, I'm using that part of my brain. So what does the cortex do? Our cortex is like 3 times bigger than an ape. An ape's cortex is 3 times bigger than a monkey. So we have all these extra neurons, and they allow us to incorporate more information into our decisions. So if I see a banana and I think, oh, does Lisa Gar want that banana? Is she bigger than me? Is she going to bite me? And then I was like, oh, well, she was nice to me before, and I don't really need the banana. She doesn't really need the banana. Whatever the information is. So that's what your cortex can bring in from your life experience. But it can bring in so much information that we try to project into the future what is going to make me happy, what is going to make me safe and meet my needs. And it's impossible to predict that with certainty because we know that the world is uncertain. So I think that's what you were asking about, why is it so hard to make these decisions?
Mm-hmm.
And because of the trade-offs, which I have a series of infographics, and my infographic number 2 is about these difficult trade-offs.
Which I find fascinating. So you basically go through these different choices that we make. If you want to make a step towards a higher status, it's a step away from our social bonds. But yen, these risks, or if you want to make a step towards your social bonds, it's maybe a step away from your individual goals. So in that position where we get into, is it, for example, you want to choose the job or the family. Do your brain wants to have that task? How does it resolve? How do you make the decision?
So each of us is going to rely on the pathways of our individual experience, sort of like what makes me happy, what's going to make me happy given the wiring that I have. The minute, though, that I make myself happy, then my brain's like, okay, now what? Now I want more. So mm-hmm. If I spend time with my kids, I feel like I should be at work. If I'm at work, I feel like I should be spending time with my kids.
Yes.
So that's sort of the natural thing because your brain is always focused on the unmet need. And whatever needs are already met, that's like ancient history. You already got the reward.
Wow. Wow. So the point is just to celebrate the fact that you have the choices.
Yes, that's what I do. And to try to remind yourself, gee, I have met needs before, and I have spent time with my kids. I have gotten things done at work. And I'm projecting all these possible things that could go wrong if I don't do more of X, Y, and Z. But in fact, I'm pretty good at meeting my survival needs.
Mm-hmm. So that's really great. So that's another word for balance, but not all at the same time. Sometimes you meet
yeah.
the needs of work. Sometimes you meet the needs of family. You go back to the work one. You go back to the self. It's different achievements at different times. But the bottom line is you have achievements, right?
Yes, yes. And also, you know, frankly, we're all going to die. And animals don't know they're going to die. So they can't scare themselves to death over it. So the minute I'm not, like, overactive, you know, distracting, then your brain is like, oh, yeah, but then that leads to that and that leads to that, and someday I'm going to be in a nursing home and blah, blah, blah. You know, that's where your brain will go because it's the job it's designed to do. So we have to work really hard at creating an alternative circuit that doesn't go there.
Well, I thought that mammals' brains are always thinking they're going to die. That's the survival instinct, right? That they're always moving towards away from death. Isn't that what survival is?
Yeah, good point. Okay, so there's a difference between an abstract cognitive knowledge of death and fear, avoidance of pain. So the animal operating system is avoiding pain and everything even remotely similar to what caused pain in the past. Okay, but they don't understand what the consequence of that is. It's just that pain triggers cortisol. Cortisol is what we humans call a stress hormone. So once you release cortisol from pain that connects neurons, the next time you see anything even vaguely similar, it turns on the cortisol circuit, and then it tells your brain, you better get away fast or you're going to be in pain.
Okay, I see.
That's avoidance of threat, but it's not like we can create the threat in our own minds even when there's no actual pain, because we see all the evidence around us. Oh, this can go wrong, this can go wrong, this can go wrong.
Right. And we do this. This is our modern day jungle, which is a city, is a way we can do that, is that we take this threat of, oh, that person's going to take my job or these types of things. And we build these cortisol pathways in the brain, basically, when we see threats, when we think we see threats. But we can control that with our modern day brain to say, no, that's not the case. Let's put this into place here and be more reasonable rather than constantly acting and stimulating. I'm trying to recreate what you're saying here, just to put it in my own words.
Well, here's the thing. If I try to recorrect with my modern brain, then my brain's going to not believe me. It's going to say, you're wrong.
Oh.
You know, she really is trying to take your job. The reason is because the electricity in your brain flows like water in a storm. It just flows where there's least resistance. So the huge superhighways that you built in the past, that's where your electricity is going to flow. So if you grew up around like a lot of worry about X, you're going to worry about X. Somebody else doesn't worry about X at all, but they're like obsessing over Y. So once you understand that pathway, the solution is to build a new pathway, because otherwise the electricity is not going to flow enough and you're not going to believe yourself. So the way to build a new pathway, like, you know, I use the example of telling yourself that you're safe. You have to repeat it every day for 45 days in some way that you can find believable, and that will build a new pathway so your electricity will flow.
45 days. So it's no longer 21 days that creates a new habit? You've got to double it, huh?
Yeah, I think it takes. You know, of course it depends on certain things. It depends on the, if I can use the word authenticity. Like, for example, if I'm eating something that tastes fabulous, then that immediate reward, it cements it in faster. But if you're really going against your huge early programming, it takes a lot longer to build new connections.
Ah, that makes sense. But then you said something important there. The brain needs to do something every day, which creates a pattern, in a way that it believes it. So you just can't tell your brain that the kale tastes like cookie, because it doesn't, right?
Yeah, exactly. So so you can feel good about kale in some other way, and that's the phenomenon we're observing now, of course. So you can get excited about kale, not because of the cookie feeling, but a whole variety of other ways to get excited about it.
Okay, well, that's interesting. Right. Just did a whole interview yesterday on the satiation of good fats, and you could layer avocados and all sorts of great things together and you won't crave the cookie anymore. Okay. Anyway, let's talk about, you mentioned basically that our brain defines us because we have for so many years built these certain pathways unconsciously sometimes when we're modeling or mirroring other behavior. Tell us how that works, and then how we might change it. And I think this is another one of those that's going to take a little while to change things, right?
Yeah. So first, it really depends on how old you were when this modeling and mirroring of behavior happened. So there's a substance in the brain called myelin, and you could think of it as equivalent to putting paving on a dirt road. And your brain makes lots of myelin when you're under 8 and during puberty. So anything that happened to you during those times, that built the paved superhighways in your brain. And those are so big that it's sort of, it takes a real lot of effort to do something alternative. So you were saying what mirroring. The behaviors you were exposed to when you were under 8 and during puberty, that your brain learned effortlessly. So you said not consciously. Of course, consciousness is a good goal, but none of us could have been conscious, you know, in those
right.
times.
So can I use you as an example? So you said you were raised with a lot of yelling, and yet you have 2 children that you didn't want to yell at. Did you?
Yeah. Okay. So I'll give you my example. So 2 things. One is that my father, he was as scared of my mother as we were. So that was the other person I was modeling his degree of self-control. Maybe self-control to an extreme degree of sort of giving up in a way of like not even trying to feel heard. And that's the circuit I wired myself with. So then in puberty, you have another chance where, and this is where most people end up modeling themselves on their peers. But in my case, and a number of people, you know, we all vary, but I didn't have a lot of peer interaction at that age. I know it's a more natural thing, and in the state of nature, it's necessary to get mating opportunity, and that's why people do it. But I was more bookish, which is part of that whole loop I had learned to just avoid conflict. And so I wired in, you know, a different set of skills, and that's why I had to accept myself. You know, some people have one skill, some people have another skill, and we make decisions, you know, I'm going to work the skills I have and maybe at some point try to build new ones.
Okay, so did you wind up marrying someone like your mother?
Oh, good question.
Weird one, I know. Sorry, going there.
Yeah. No, well, first I should say that I sort of have a policy of, like, not talking about people who are alive as opposed to people who are not alive.
I'm talking about you, though.
No,
okay.
No, but he was, but no, I don't want to give the impression. No, he was self-controlled like my father. You know, and I've had 2 husbands, by the way, and they've both been, you know, very calm and good models in that way, like my father.
Mm-hmm. It's just interesting. I can give myself as an example, so that works. But I too was raised in that type of environment where my dad tended to be quieter and not go through the control that was happening necessarily from the dominant person in the relationship. So I took on that quietness, right? Yet I married somebody who wanted to, and look what I've set up for myself, you know, radio shows where I get to speak my truth all day.
Yeah.
And I married someone who encourages me to speak my truth, although he sees, you know, it's great because you marry the catalyst. You know, you find somebody in your life who's going to create the biggest amount of change for you. And somehow, I don't know what that has to do with survival, Loretta, but I know that somehow it works. Can you explain that? Why we tend to marry someone who contributes the most to our survival?
Oh, yeah. Well, my view is, like, each of us has so many different traits that any one person I would be with, I would have this in common, but I would not have that in common. So, you know, ideally, you know, we look for someone that makes us feel good, but you can't get absolutely every single thing. So you focus on what's your highest priority, and it's not always so conscious, you know, what is your highest priority.
Right. You shouldn't be a professor. You should be a psychologist. That's what you should do. Psychiatrist, actually. Wouldn't it be great if you know, your level of knowledge is so wonderful for explaining human behavior. It's just fascinating. So again, my guest is Loretta Brunig, and her book that we're talking about today is Happy Habits of a Happy Brain. And all right, so question about why do we make things so hard for ourselves? What's up with that?
Good. Okay, so I mentioned that cortisol wires you to avoid pain. So you're always making a choice, do I want to go toward a reward or do I want to avoid pain? And there's no simple solution. And then here's the fascinating thing. What most distinguishes us from animals, from apes, is our ability to project into the future. So you know, an animal maybe can project one step, you know, oh, if I grab that banana, I'm going to get bitten. But we project, oh, but what's the next step? What's the next step? What's the next step? So if I project 20 years into the future and all possible pain and all possible rewards, you know, and then look for the optimal answer, it's hard. And that's one aspect of modern culture that I almost feel like guilty of, that I was like contributor to, because when I was teaching years ago, there was a lot of talk about quality improvement, and there was a lot of complaint that the quality of our products was poor. And so we were always supposed to anticipate flaws so we could correct them. And that's what everybody's doing, is like anticipating things that could go wrong and, you know, going to a restaurant and looking for stuff that's going wrong instead of enjoying it. You know what I mean?
Yes, right. So we do that because we tend to, as human beings, project far into the future?
Yes, yes. And that's what made us safe. What I say is, I've hardly lost any of my babies to lions at all, you know.
Right, right, right.
Animals, they lose their babies to lions. But humans said, oh, if I don't build a fence, a lion could get my baby, so I'll build a fence. If I don't store food, I'll be hungry in winter. So that's what distinguishes us, is worrying about our future needs rather than just filling our belly today.
So presence would be maybe a solution for that, is being...
Yeah, but obviously if you only worry about the present, then you can get into trouble. So it's the skill of giving yourself permission. You know, when do I give myself permission to just be present and stop worrying about the future? And then how do I gracefully go in and out of that?
I'm going to go back over industry here, back towards it, but that's what insurance companies do, is that they prey on that aspect of the brain, that chemical in the brain that needs to plan far ahead into the future against its death or extinction. So it gets insurance.
Yeah, yeah. And once again, you know, you can buy insurance and then say, okay, I have insurance, now I'm safe. Or you could say, I have insurance, but I'm still worried. Maybe the insurance isn't good enough. Maybe I need more insurance, blah, 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 blah.
That could be with anything. It could be house. It could be finances. It could be anything.
Yes.
It's all related to, I keep relating it back to marketing and how we're marketed towards our neurochemicals. And if we were a little bit, and this would be your next book, okay, Loretta?
Yeah.
Of how we, you know, how we can make smarter decisions and not fall prey to the latest fads. That's basically everything, single one of these sectors of business that I've mentioned are all preying on our neurochemistry of survival. It could be shopping, it could be insurance, it could be finance, all of it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, that's definitely true. But to put it in a larger context, which is, so here, I told you my personal experience. So when I was in my formative teen years, I was not, I never had the urge to get the latest whatever, you know, because I was so focused on what was going on, other problems. So we all, this is so hard to say. So you get membership in the herd when you go along with whatever you learned. And if you don't go along with it, it really threatens your membership in the herd. And people are worried, yeah, but if I don't go along with that blah, 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 then the most famous example is an alcoholic saying, if I don't drink, I'll lose all my friends.
Right.
You know?
Great example. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it really is hard. Like, how can we have social bonds that are not bonded around these behaviors? And it's very hard because in the state of nature, this is what created the bond. It's really funny. Every single animal, if you study, they have conflict within their groups, but what keeps them in the group is a common enemy. And that's why people are so focused on, and I mean, you could even say the common enemy is the person who doesn't have the purse, like we all have the purse, but, you know, that person doesn't, or whatever unifies your group. Then there's the out-group, and the in-group gets its oxytocin from the links created by the out-group, the existence of the out-group, because otherwise we all have conflict in our groups, and that's what creates the warm and fuzzy feeling anyway.
Wow, that's so fascinating. It's really fascinating to explain all of this. I was listening to a blog, or it was a interview that you did about comparing ourselves to others. And
and
how this instinct to compare ourselves to others, again, happens from what you were just explaining, that it's oxytocin forming, right? When we are comparing ourselves to others. How do you break that habit and create a new pathway in our brain around comparing ourselves to others so it doesn't look like competition, but it looks like cooperation instead, maybe?
Yeah, I think it's serotonin rather than oxytocin, comparing yourself to others, because if I compare myself to you, then I think I'm going to be the one to get the mating opportunity if I'm in the right position, and then I feel good. Or I think you're the one that's going to get the mating opportunity, and then I feel bad. And people may be thinking, oh, that's just men, but, you know, in a zillion different ways, it happens with women. So just read the mating habits of all these species and you'll see.
Wow.
It's mind-blowing.
It is.
So, I mean, that they, like, the bonobos, which are the ones that are known for, like, being so sexual, the females are constantly competing to get the son of the highest-ranking female. Isn't that mind-blowing?
Wow.
So how do we not do that? How do we not compare ourselves to others? When our brain is going to go there, it's the best we can do. The first step is to not make ourselves miserable over it. And this is the subject of another book I wrote called iMammal. iMammal, Why Your Brain Links Status and Happiness. And the idea is to focus on how I have the one-up position. It sounds crude, so we could call it pride or confidence, but how can I feel good about myself without putting another person down? Because if I have to do it by putting them down, then I'm going to be in a constant little war in my brain. So we can all find our own way to do it, but I'll tell you how I did it. I studied the heck out of my ancestors, and man, their lives were awful. People don't realize this, but in Sicily and Italy, they had dirt floors and no toilets until the 50s and 60s, the 1950s and 60s. You know, by the way, nobody had flush toilets, you know, like 100 years ago. So this is, we can feel good about how much more we have than our ancestors.
Ah, so that's a good way of balancing that out. We've talked a lot about the brain. We've talked a lot about why we do the things we do. And I love offering these simple experiences that actually can recreate or create a new pathway in the brain. So instead of comparing ourselves to others and putting others down, study our ancestors and realize how good we have it.
That's one example. People might find another example. The one that's very popular today is sort of like, I eat more kale than you eat.
Okay.
But again, these are all like, at some point you're going to then feel
that's
like,
funny.
Oh, I have to eat nothing but kale in order to feel good about myself. You can end up feeling bad.
That's very interesting. It's also has to do with your own personal goals and your own personal tempo and your own personal body. When you really look at it that way, you really have nobody else to compare yourself to if you're really just focusing on yourself. Not from the reptilian perspective about being, you know, alone in solidarity, but from that perspective of respecting your own body, what you put in, is what you get out type of thing.
Yes, absolutely. But the fact is, as much as I want to not compare myself to others and to just focus on myself, that you know, you catch your brain going there, and so you have to keep pulling it back. That's the funny thing about this, like, internet addiction that everyone's talking about, like, sort of a Facebook is the modern venue for comparing yourself to others.
Ah, so awareness is maybe 80% of the solution, but you need a tool, you need a technique. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
Can we talk about that a little bit, about the brain's need for Facebook? I mean, I think we just did.
Yeah. Let's do each one of the chemicals. So first, dopamine is expecting a reward. So for example, if you went to your computer yesterday and you got 3 more likes than you've ever gotten in your whole life.
Oh my gosh.
That felt great. That was dopamine. But you know what? The dopamine was gone in a short time, and now you go to your computer today and you got 3 less likes. And so now you feel bad. So for the rest of your life now, you're going to have to get more likes than that in order to feel good. So that's sort of the dopamine treadmill that exists in our brain. So now let's go to oxytocin. So Facebook is a way to create a group feeling, and like every time I feel alone, it's just easy, quick way to access it. Of course, making oxytocin bonds with real life humans is a little more risky. So that's the whole thing about how we avoid pain. So if I invite someone for coffee, they might reject me, but Facebook is always there.
Right.
So that's the next one. So serotonin, you know, serotonin, the one-up position, you know, it's easy on the internet to find people who you feel like you got it going on more than them. That's easy to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, let's say endorphin. Hopefully I, you know, use it to laugh.
Ah, I see. Wow. That's the neurochemical aspects of Facebook. I love it. No, fascinating. So many great studies. So I encourage you to check out Loretta's website, which is innermammalinstitute.org.
.org.
Yes.
Yeah, .org.
Innermammalinstitute.org. And the book we're talking about today is Habits of a Happy Brain, Retrain Your Brain to Boost Serotonin, Dopamine, Oxytocin, and Endorphin Levels. Thank you so much, Loretta. Fascinating, fascinating information. I appreciate you as a guest. Thank you.
Thank you so much. It was great.
It was fun. All right. And also, I want to remind you one more time to go to the website to check out that series that I did on Gaia TV. It's called Lisa's Inspirations, and you can check the website out at lisasinspirations.com and watch it and feel good. It'll boost your serotonin. It'll boost all of your great, happy neurochemicals. All right. Thank you so much. And that's it for me today. Thank you to Joyce Walker, producer of The Aware Show, Gina Salvati, executive producer of The Aware Show, and G here, an engineer here at KPFK. And thank you so much for listening, because you are involved here and your energy around the show makes it happen. So thank you. And until next time, I invite you to stay aware.